Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And you are listening to Pod Yourself a Gun, which is a Sopranos podcast where we go through every episode of The Sopranos one by one.
And we watch it starting from episode one to episode last.
Which is exactly how you watch a TV show. That's the normal way.
All Vince. Chronological-like.
Yeah. We now, a lot of you are wondering why anyone would start a Sopranos podcast now. Well, the first reason is I don't think podcast technology was invented when Sopranos started.
That's very true, yeah.
And also, it's kind of Vince and my favorite show. And
you had to talk into a cup attached to a string and just hope someone was at the other end.
Right, That was the original podcasting. It was either that or you were on the radio. And there was too much swearing in The Sopranos for the radio. So now that it's, 2019, we decided, why not? You know, I've rewatched Sopranos multiple times. And every time I rewatch it, I learn something new. And so we decided,
maybe you could learn something new with us.
Yeah, maybe you could,
Hey.
Hey, whatever. Forget about it,
And for our inaugural guest, we have Alan Sepinwall, who wrote a book called The Soprano Sessions that just came out.
It did, yeah. It came out 2 days before the 20th anniversary.
Perfect.
Nice.
So wait, should we play the theme song?
Oh, yeah. So we have a theme song that I created on a free audio program called Audacity. And so, yeah, let's do it. Let's play it.
Okay.
Yeah. Pod. Pod. Pod.
Oh, boy.
Podcast. Pod. 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 Podcast.
So that's the theme. That's the theme song.
Guys, is it too late for me to back out?
Yes, it is too late.
You are already on. We're pressed record and everything. So yeah, that's the theme song. Here's the thing. I am no music producer,
No, it was great. I think it was great. So Alan, I feel like your area of expertise is probably knowing a little bit about like production and development. What did you learn about, how The Sopranos originally came about?
Well, I mean, it's amazing. It originally just started as the idea that David Chase would tell stories about his mother and how they didn't get along, and everyone would always laugh. And finally, his wife Denise said, "You should make a show about that." And it sort of merged with the idea that Paramount wanted him to do Godfather, the TV show, which he rightly thought would be a terrible idea.
Yeah, good call on his part. My God.
But he combined that with the mother idea and realized like a screenwriter with a difficult mother, who's going to want to watch that? A mob boss with a difficult mother, that could be kind of interesting, but it still went through a lot of evolutions. Originally, his idea was for something much more in the comedy vein. Like he called it a live action Simpsons, and that was when he was seriously considering Steve Van Zandt to play Tony. And then Jim Gandolfini walked in and everything changed for the better.
Steve Van Zandt, who plays Silvio, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was one of the two runners up to play Tony, him and Michael Rispoli, who wound up playing Jackie Aprile Sr.
Oh.
Is Steve Van Zandt Italian at all?
Yes.
Okay.
Because he feels Italian.
Yeah, his name doesn't sound Italian.
He's quite Italian.
Yeah. So, which is an interesting thing about this show to me, because, well, first of all, like rewatching, I hadn't rewatched it since it came out. I watched it all of it when it came out, and I haven't rewatched it since.
Really?
Yeah. And rewatching the first episode, I expected it to feel dated somehow, or to not be as good as I remembered.
No, the show holds up,
and it absolutely holds up.
It's crazy.
And another thing about this show that I really enjoy is, like, I don't know, maybe this is overly earnest, but like, I'm an Italian person, my dad's Italian.
Yeah, Mancini.
Mancini.
Your name is the name of the bastard son of Sonny Corleone.
Yeah, Andy Garcia played me in Godfather Part 3,
exactly.
Which they rip on in the first episode of The Sopranos.
The best of all the Godfather films, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like, I grew up, like, in Central California, in the Central Valley, and I never, other than my name and the fact that, you know, we like ate Italian food, I never felt like particularly Italian.
Uh-huh.
And like my Italian grandparents, my grandfather died when I was like 5, and my grandmother died when I was like, I don't know, 12, like 13, uh-huh. So somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And so, like, I never felt particularly Italian. Like, I didn't really, I didn't identify with all the stereotypes,
sure,
of like East Coast Italians.
Right. You didn't have a big bushy mustache.
Right,
you weren't,
yeah,
a plumber.
Yeah,
you didn't have a brother named Luigi.
I didn't wear a Speedo and a big medallion and grab my crotch all the time.
Sure.
I swam, so I did.
Little
wear a
known
Speedo.
Fact, my cousin played Luigi on the Captain Lou Albano Super Mario Brothers Power Hour.
Oh,
wow. Nice.
Yeah. But so
even though we're Jewish, we're kind of Italian too.
Yeah, same thing.
Well, all Jews are kind of Italian and vice versa, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but then watching the show, just the way that Tony interacts with his mom,
uh-huh,
is like my dad and grandmother to a T.
Yeah.
And so it's like watching this weird, like, half-remembered echo of my family that I didn't,
sure,
really know in a weird way. And yeah, it's, and like, it, I don't know, it made me realize, like, oh yeah, I guess we do share some things, you know, at that level. Anyway.
Well, I have a question about David Chase's experience, like, making The Sopranos, in terms of the fact that, you know, Analyze This came out like 3 months after Sopranos came out, which means they were in production at the same time. Did he know Analyze This was going to come out?
I don't think that Matt Zellersites and I, who wrote the book with me, ever directly asked him that. But I do remember at the time when we were covering the show for the Star Ledger, which was Tony's newspaper.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, like, just everyone was conflating the two and assuming that, like, this was going to be some dumb, goofy comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And at least the movie had De Niro and Billy Crystal. And who the hell was this Gandolfini guy and all of that?
Yeah.
And it really wasn't until College, the fifth episode, which you guys are going to get to in a bit,
mm-hmm,
that people really fully understood, oh, this is something different. This is something really serious and probably great.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's clearly, I mean, miles away from actually being Analyze This. But sometimes if you think about it, like, what would happen if instead of Sopranos coming out January 1999, Analyze This came out January 1999, and Sopranos came out in March 1999,
yeah,
maybe we'd be sitting here talking about Analyze This. You ever think of
the funny, the funny thing is, Chase didn't want to make a TV show. He wanted to make a movie. He wanted to get out of the TV business. And his dream casting was De Niro for Tony and Anne Bancroft for Livia.
Wow.
And he just couldn't get it off the ground. And then when he made the pilot, he didn't want HBO to pick it up because he didn't want to do a TV show. And he hoped he could just scrounge enough money to film another hour and take it to Cannes.
Nah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I think things worked out a little better.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think so he used, like, unknown actors, but not entirely unknown actors. Like, I think I had seen Gandolfini in 8mm. I think I've remembered him licking Nick Cage's gun in 8mm because he plays, like, the weird,
yeah,
pornographer who beats the prostitute
sure,
to death or
sure,
whatever.
Sure.
So, like, I sort of remembered him. And then, of course, Lorraine Bracco was, you know, Karen in Goodfellas.
Right.
So, like, we sort of knew him, but not really.
But
which is kind of like the perfect amount of well-knownness for a TV show, I think.
Right. But also, then you've got Edie Falco, who I think was a complete unknown at the time. I mean, she was on Broadway with something.
She had been on Oz for a few seasons.
Oh,
so
that's
an
what
HBO
it was.
Track
she,
record.
She was on Oz, yeah. And we had Michael Imperioli, who was another one. Had he done anything?
Yeah, he's Spider from Goodfellas.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
There was a lot of like...
I thought you said I was all right, Spider.
Yeah. Goodfellas and The Sopranos, they had a lot of casting tie-ins.
Also known as like every mob movie show. Like tends to reuse the same actors.
There's only 15 Italian actors in Hollywood. Yeah, everyone knows
like,
that.
If there was no mob movies, like Frank Vincent would not have a career.
Well, Frank Vincent came in to read for Uncle Junior, and basically one of the reasons he didn't get the part was Chase worried there were too many people from Goodfellas in the show already.
Yeah, oh, man. For sure. So, okay, so let's talk about the episode itself. So the first thing that you see, if you'd never watched Sopranos before, is that theme sequence.
Yeah.
And of all the things that hold up about The Sopranos, that intro song is by far like the most laughable anachronism, I think.
Oh, definitely. That might be not only the worst theme song in television history, but maybe one of the worst songs ever written. It's weird because the show is amazing in how it holds up, but that song, it took me a while to kind of like see it from a different perspective, where it wasn't the Sopranos theme song, it was just a song.
Right.
That someone listened to. Someone played it in a car one time while I was driving, and I was like, this is terrible. Turn this off immediately.
It comes from that era of, I don't know if you remember the Howard Stern movie Private Parts, which I think came out like maybe a couple years before this. Uh-huh. And he had like the Chemical Brothers that did like a theme song for that movie. It was like, I'm a tortured man, or I'm a something man. Do you remember that, Alan?
Not exactly.
Okay, but
when I hear Chemical Brothers these days, I think of the DJ Twins from Baskets.
Yeah,
which is a very deep cut.
Yeah, yes, it is.
Or the underground rave from the second Matrix. Was that them too?
Yeah, the intro music to what do you call it? Fight Club. That was Chemical Brothers.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I don't know. But I can't tell the difference between them and the Dust Brothers.
Oh, that might be Dust Brothers.
I have no idea. But
there
was
a lot of brother DJs in the 90s, and you know they had a lot of boom boom music. But I tell you, this song is just terrible. It's just super super bad all the way through. The lyrics make no sense. It doesn't even really fit with the theme of the show in any way, which is kind of interesting. It's like the song is just way off. It's the only
Mama
thing...
said you were the chosen one, so you got yourself a gun. Yeah. I don't know.
Born under
a bad sign.
Yeah, with the blue moon in your eyes.
Yeah, blue moon.
Yeah, what? I'm not sure.
You saw me shooting alone.
So other than the fact that it is a terrible theme song, the actual what they shoot in the opening sequence is interesting because it's if you've ever been across to the New Jersey Turnpike all the way to, where does he live? West Orange or something like that? North Caldwell, that's right. Then my dad, who was born in Newark and then moved to West Orange later, he would watch the intro and he would be like, I know all these places. Uh-huh.
He also born under a bad sign?
I mean, you know, he's a libertarian, if that's what you're asking.
Okay, sure. So then the actual structure of the show itself, it starts in the psychiatrist's office. And it's very much structured like Portnoy's Complaint by Philip Roth, you know, where the whole structure of it is the framing device is Tony's visit to the psychiatrist.
Right, yeah. And everything is run through that. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of... you're introduced to everything in the show. It's the pilot.
Right.
The first thing I noticed is... Alan, tell me if you noticed this too, but do you notice that in terms of Tony's character, in terms of his voice in the pilot, he's figuring it out in the pilot episode?
No, for sure. And I mean, he's a lot skinnier than he is in the series. You know, Robert Eiler, played AJ, is like, you know, 12 years old and looks like he's 8.
Yeah.
There's a different father, Phil. Silvio isn't part of the crew yet. When he shows up at the pork store,
right,
they're all surprised to see him.
Hey, what are you doing here?
Exactly. It's like Tony and Artie Bucco haven't seen each other in years, when in every other episode, they're like the best friends who hang out all the time. There's a lot of things that they were still tweaking at that point.
Yeah, you know, I feel the worst for the person who played Father Intentola, because... What happened? Why did they recast him? Was he recast? Did he quit?
I think they just wanted it. you know, he's only in the one scene. He's only got a couple lines in the pilot, and they realized it was going to be a bigger deal. And Paul Schultz, who played Father Phil for the rest of the run, had gone to college with Edie and had done like a whole bunch of acting with her over the years. So they had really strong chemistry.
Yeah.
And so, you know, out went, I think Michael Santoro is his name.
Yeah.
In came Paul Schultz. They recast a few roles. There's a different, Big Pussy's wife is different in the first season.
Right.
Silvio's wife is different. And a couple of others. The weirdest is they recast the FBI agent, you know, who deals with Adriana, and then they reshot all the footage with her, so you can't actually see Fairuza Balk in the role anymore.
Oh, wow. Fairuza Balk.
Wait. Fairuza Balk was which one? The Danielle? The one who
projects? Yes.
Who, what? if you don't know who she is, she is the one with an interesting face. She was in The Craft.
She's in The Craft. She's the evil witch from The Craft. She was in Waterboy.
Yeah, she played
Adam Sandler's girlfriend. What else has she been in?
Those are the two main ones that I remember.
Man, but she was huge.
She was also in American History X?
She was. She played a Nazi in American History X. So wait, that is, I mean, I know we're skipping ahead many, many episodes.
But derailing the very first episode of your podcast.
Listen,
this
is a podcast not just for people who have seen, or who haven't seen The Sopranos. This is specifically for people who've seen it and love it. I mean, you really have to be someone who loves The Sopranos to listen to Sopranos podcast that started in 2019. So
no, you don't have to like, The Sopranos. You don't have to like TV. You don't have to know about, this podcast is for anyone, for everyone. For your grandmother,
this is very broad. This is if you love Jesus, if you love Muhammad, just anyone can love this podcast.
Right.
But so wait, what happened with Fairuza Balk? Why did they recast her? Was she terrible? Give me the tea.
I don't know. There's Matt and I did like 8 long depth interviews with David Chase for this book, and there's like, and he answered a lot of stuff, including he talked about the ending much more than we expected him to.
Yeah.
But there's a handful of things that I had on my list, like I want to know about this, I want to know about that, and he would not spill. And one of them was why he recast Fairuza Balk.
Wow.
Another one was why Feach Lamana went back to prison so soon, and there was one or two others where he just clammed up. We will never know.
Man,
she might have been too Fairuza Balky for this role.
That's true. That's true. She is someone who's very Fairuza Balk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She only plays.
But at least the original Father Phil you can still see when you watch the pilot, where all footage of Fairuza Balk has been destroyed.
That is so crazy. Was there a body double? So the actress who played Danielle was never.
Lola Guadagnini.
She was never actually in the room, or did they reshoot those? They reshot those scenes.
I think they just reshot. There's like, she's only in a couple of scenes in the season 3 finale, and I think in a lot of cases she was the only person in the shot, so it wasn't very difficult for them to do it.
Wow. Well, R.I.P. Fairuza Balk. So back to the pilot episode. I think, number one, you mentioned Fat AJ. And I got to say, cutest AJ of the series.
I mean, immediately, he's sort of like the most openly scumbaggy character. And I was surprised at how early on they sort of established him as a scumbag. Like the very first shot of him, you don't see his face. You just see his 8-ball cap. He's wearing a backward cap with an eight ball on it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, which was super popular for skater kids in the 90s.
Yeah.
This show has a lot of, like, it brings me back to the 90s, but it's like it just transcends it in this way, too. It's amazing. It's like it really is the bridge between the 90s and where we are now.
Right. So Tony is in Dr. Melfi's office, and he explains that he's there because he had a panic attack, and they wanted him to see. They established that he didn't seek out going to a shrink on his own.
Right.
It was something that was sort of ordered by a doctor.
Yeah, his next door neighbor, Dr. Cusimano.
Yeah, and there's a series of flashbacks, and the first one, which it's Tony out at his house, just like looking at his pool, and he's wearing a bathrobe and like boxer shorts and a necklace, which is very Italian.
Sure.
And the ducks come and they land in his pool, and there's a subplot about ducks, and that's like a running thread throughout The Sopranos, is that Tony has this weird obsession with animals.
Yeah, and encounters with animals,
right?
For sure.
And so he's very excited about the ducks, and he's calling his kids over to see the ducks. And immediately, it's like this funny dichotomy. It reminded me of Al Madrigal, who's a stand-up comedian, had like a bit about cholos in nature, which was kind of the same thing. It's like Guidos in nature. It was very good.
Yeah, it definitely follows the kind of like, it's the same thing with the Coen brothers, where they're just like, you know, put people with funny accent in interesting situations.
Yeah.
You know, Guido's saying anything that's not mafioso, like related, is very funny.
Hey, look at these ducks over here.
Yeah, right, yeah. Hey, I'm about to eat some fucking kale, like, you know, like anything like that. So one of the segments that we will eventually have on this show, once we have bumpers and shit like that, and listeners, is going to be called Bada B Stories. And this is where I think we can all just say what our favorite B story, or kind of like something that's a peripheral thing that later becomes a thing in The Sopranos.
Right.
My personal favorite is the introduction of Pussy Malenga, who is a character who you will never see much of, I mean, at all beyond this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But spoiler alert, if you've never watched The Sopranos, he is the reason in Uncle Junior's head that he shoots Tony. He thinks he's shooting Pussy Malenga.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Because the plot in this one is that Junior's trying to whack Pussy Malenga.
Right.
And he's going to do it in Artie Bucco's restaurant.
Right.
And Tony doesn't want him to do it there,
because it'll ruin his business.
Yeah.
To have
he's a, being a good friend.
Yeah. So his solution eventually is, first he tries to get him tickets so he can leave town so the restaurant will close and I have to choose a new place to kill Pussy Malenga. But he decides not to, because his wife doesn't want him to take tickets from a mobster, even though they later are just best friends after this episode. So instead he burns down Vesuvio.
Yeah, which I think is very much a theme in Goodfellas also, where like being friends with mafia guys
means burning down your restaurant.
It's like, it's the greatest thing that happened to you, and also the worst thing that happens to you.
Yeah, that's the relationship, I think, with mafiosos.
Yeah.
That's how it is.
Like, Tony's trying to do him a solid, and at first it means getting him tickets to go on a cruise, but eventually it means burning down his restaurant.
Sure, sure. And but later in the series, what ends up happening is, as Uncle Junior is slowly losing his mind, he ends up shooting Tony Soprano, thinking he is Pussy Malenga.
Right.
And I thought that was that's a great nugget for anyone who watches The Sopranos over and over every few years.
Uh-huh. And so my favorite B story, if you can call it a B story,
sure,
is of course Tony is trying to get his mother to come to AJ's birthday party.
Sure.
And so the first scene where we meet Livia, who's Tony's mom, is he's trying to get her to come. And here, I have a clip of that, so I'll play that.
Yeah.
Who's there?
It's me, Ma.
Who are you?
Ma, open the door.
Anthony?
Yeah, it's me. Open the door.
Did you lock the door after you?
Yeah, I did.
You know, somebody called you last night after Jock.
Oh.
You think I'd answer? It was Jock out.
Which, again, reminded me so much of my grandma for some reason. Just like the way that like old Italian people have these weird rules about things that are very confusing and make no sense for anyone else.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely it's an old Italian thing. It's an old person thing in general. Mm-hmm. Then again,
you got to have the respect. But what respect actually means is, oh, you can't call after dark.
Yeah, exactly. And that's when we're first introduced to Livia Soprano, right? That is the first
scene. That's the first scene, yeah.
Which is just an amazing scene for a pilot episode. I mean, it's just, it really is. I mean, I don't know how much David Chase had preconceived of the entire relationship between Tony and his mother. I know it's based on him and his mother, which, by the way, does that mean that David Chase, his mother, tried to kill him?
No, it's exaggerated at least a little bit, guys.
Sure.
But yeah, it's amazing to me that it just shows the entire arc of this character in and this relationship in one scene.
And what do you know about the casting of that particular actress? Because like at this point, like she is only Tony Soprano's mom to me.
Yeah.
Well, she was, after Lorraine Bracco, she was probably the most famous person in the original cast because she had played Lou Grant's boss on Lou Grant for years, Mrs. Pynchon. She was the sort of hoity-toity rich lady who owned a newspaper.
Huh.
And what was amazing was Nancy was sick when she got, she died after the second season, and they knew she was sick when they hired her.
Oh.
And I asked David, and I don't know that he knew she would die that soon, but I asked him specifically, like, obviously she was great, and that's one of the best performances in the run of the show, but if you'd known then what you know now, that you would only have 2 years of her, and that she would be too sick to really do a lot in the second of those 2 years, would you have gone with someone else? And he's like, there was nobody else. Every other person they brought in was just not good, and she came in, and she was his mother.
Yeah. And so, again, like, she's so perfect, and part of that I definitely think is, you know, like, you can tell she's a little bit infirm in that. And then the entire plot where they're trying to get her to come to AJ's birthday party, it's not necessarily because they like her. Like, she's kind of a pill, and the entire family kind of thinks that she's a pain in the ass. And she's done this thing where after Tony's dad has died, she's like, oh, he was a saint.
Yeah.
And he's like, you didn't like him that much when he was alive.
Yeah. Whittled him down. He was a squealing.
Warmed down to a little nub.
Yeah. He was a squealing little gerbil when he died.
Yeah. And so just the plot where they want to keep her around because of her cooking, like, that reminded me of my grandma. And then that culminates in AJ finding out that she's not going to come to his birthday
and
party.
Summing it up in the perfect way.
Yeah. And I have a clip of that, which I think was my favorite clip of the whole show.
Okay.
So what, no fucking ZD now?
Hey!
All he wants is ZD. Yeah. I love AJ as little fat kid who like dips his, what is it? He dips things in milk, like a whole croissant or like
a
donut.
He's a little slob. He's a mini Tony.
He's a mini little
He's
Tony.
He's like a mini scumbag Tony.
Yeah, it's adorable just watching him grow up in the series, but he kind of, you know, he changes from the physical appearance of Tony to the mental appearance of Tony in a way. But yeah, that is pretty perfect. You also get to see in terms of back to Liv and Tony, the entire conversation that they have. We have a clip of the retirement community, right?
Yes.
It's the second. Yeah. Let's play a little.
CD player.
For who? For me? I don't want it.
Mind you, something to occupy your mind. When Dad died, you're going to do all kinds of things.
Oh, he was a saint.
Yeah, I know he was. But he's gone. You're going to travel. You're going to get a volunteer job. You've done nothing.
Stop telling me how to live my life. You just shut up.
I just worry about you.
And don't start with that nursing home business again.
It's not a nursing home. How many times do I got to say this? It's a retirement community. You're an active senior your own age. You go places. You do things.
Oh, I've seen these women in these nursing homes, in these wheelchairs, battling like idiots.
Yeah. So that was, and also her relationship to technology where the son tries to do a nice thing for her, and she's like, oh, a CD player.
It's,
never.
It's not even just the relationship to technology. It's the relationship to anyone doing anything out of kindness.
Right.
Is immediately... And she might want the thing. Mm-hmm. She might want it, but she gets off on, like, denying people their, you know, their pleasantries. And it's such a dark character trait. But it's so fucking funny.
Yeah, and she's very, she's always complimentary about people when they're not in the room.
Yeah, right. I mean, she has she has an entirely different personality depending on who she's talking to as well. I mean, she has an entirely different view of the person, which is just emotional abuse, really.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not really a fun thing.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
But, you know, watching Tony kind of like being whittled down by his mother, you know, throughout that entire scene, you just see where he gets all of his anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Where they hector each other to death
a little bit.
Yeah.
Because you think it's going to be like, oh, what is a mobster, you know, what is he worried about? Well, getting killed, you know, his business going wrong. But most of his anxiety seems to come from the fact that his mother just does not love him.
Right. And then, so do you want to go to our next segment?
Oh, are we talking about dreams?
Sure.
All right. This segment is it's called Only in Dreams. Yeah, very good. You know, Alan,
we're working
on the bumpers. This is, you know, we're going to work some kinks out for sure. But that was a great bumper. Great bumper.
So my impulse to maybe wait until the podcast was a little more polished, maybe that was the right one, I'm thinking.
No. This is, it only gets worse from here.
Right now, we got beginner's luck.
Yeah.
You have to factor that in.
And everything is actually just working out really well.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
So this is now the segment where we talk about one of the many dreams. Every episode, well, not every episode, but there's a lot of dream sequences. I feel like the way David Chase did dream sequences in this show, basically every other, you know, a TV show has tried to copy.
Yes.
Which is
funny because it was not that great in this show. And
I thought it was perfect.
People rightly tried to talk about it.
every dream sequence I thought was amazing. It was, I mean, that's my personal opinion. What didn't you like about him?
So I like it at the beginning when he's just talking about his dream.
Sure.
Which we have a clip of that, by the way.
Okay.
I had a dream last night. My belly button was a Phillips head screw. And I'm working on screwing it. And when I get it unscrewed, my penis falls off. You know, I pick it up, I'm holding it, and I'm running around looking for the guy who used to work on my Lincoln when I drove Lincoln so he can put it back on. And, you know, I'm holding it up, and this bird swoops down, grabs it in its beak, and flies off with it.
What kind of bird?
I don't know. Seagull or something.
A water bird?
I saw the birds last week on cable. You think maybe that planted the idea?
Yeah. So bird flies off with his dick.
And it's funny because, you know, that is him just describing his dream sequence. And then you've got later in the series some of the best dream sequences, I think, on television ever, and has been copied by every prestige television show ever since. And to me, what I enjoy about it is these are, I don't know about you, I don't know what kind of dreams either of you guys have, but these are almost to the T exactly the type of dreams that I have. Most of my dreams involve either my penis falling off, teeth falling out, me going back to high school and being yelled at by a teacher. These are the dreams I have, and occasionally a big mouth Billy Bass talking at me for reasons I cannot get into at this particular moment. But I thought the dream sequences were perfect. Alan, did you ask David Chase about the dream sequences and if he had, you know, if any of them were based off the way he particularly dreams? Did he envision it in certain ways, or did he just kind of create the style on his own?
I don't think we necessarily talked about whether they were similar to his dreams, although we did discuss his version of the test dream at one point when we were talking about the test dream. And in fact, Matt and I were also sharing our versions of it. So that's, if you want to get very autobiographical and self-indulgent, that part of the book's pretty good there.
When you say the test dream?
That's an episode.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the episode from season 5.
Yeah.
You know, where he's in the plaza. Mm-hmm. And it's like a 20-minute long dream sequence about Tony Blundetto.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's also a famous anxiety dream where, like, you're preparing, you know, you have a test in school and you haven't studied.
Got it. Yes.
That's what the name comes from. But no, he didn't talk specifically about whether they were informed by his so much as just he liked the style of it. You know, he'd grown up on a lot of, like, you know, artsy fartsy, as I think he put it at one point, you mm-hmm. know, French and European cinema of the 1960s. He loved watching movies like that. And he also just wanted to be a lot more abstract than television was. And he wanted the dreams to feel like dreams, but he also had to put enough in there so that the viewers could come out with some kind of interpretation of it. So sometimes they're a little more literal than an actual dream would be,
right,
just because it's there for the sake of drama.
Right, right, right. I mean, the one thing that I enjoyed about most of the dream sequences was usually the sound design of it. There was something he would do with a lot of chewing sounds and a lot of things where you weren't sure it was a dream until you started getting these kind of like these auditory cues. And then eventually you would get the visual cues because you would have crazy shit happen, like bullets turning into chocolate in his hands. Listen, most of the dreams that I have are things that involve me having anxiety or a dinosaur chasing me. Now, he didn't have too many dinosaurs chasing him in The Sopranos, which I think is a bummer because, number one, it would have been good CG for HBO to do that. And number two, I mean, who doesn't fucking love a dinosaur? Jurassic Park.
Sure.
Millions of dollars.
Well, I think they did that in Tree of Life.
They did do that in Tree of Life. Mm-hmm.
And had some dinosaurs. And we all love that movie and remember it well.
Oh, sure. Yes. No, let's move on to more plot points that I like in general.
Okay.
We got, what is he, Meadow and Carm. We've got Artie and Vesuvio.
Christopher and the Pork Store.
Yeah. So Chris
kills Emile Kohler.
Yeah. So that guy was not a very good actor, but I still love that scene where Christopher is basically subtly insulting his culture, where he's like, Czechoslovakia, that's a type of Polak, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he keeps calling him email the entire... The amount of, like, just mispronunciations and malapropisms in the show is fantastic.
Which brings us to...
Oh, malapropism corner. Another thing that we are going to have an incredible bumper for at some point.
I'm sure.
Yes, yes, yes. So the first is we've got right after he kills Email, he and Big Pussy Bombancero are trying to dispose of the body, and then he describes the situation thusly.
Louis Brazzi sleeps with the fishes. Luca Brazzi. Luca. Whatever.
So that's one, that's like an acknowledged malapropism,
sure,
which is like one facet of the show. Mm-hmm. And then the other facet is the unacknowledged malapropisms, which I kind of like even better, where they kind of just do it and nobody corrects them.
Yeah, and it's not until later in the show that we get far more of those with Little Carmine, but go ahead.
Something I gotta confess. What are you doing?
Getting my wine in position to throw in your damn face.
You always with the drama.
You go ahead and confess already, please. Get it over with.
I'm on Prozac.
Oh my God.
I've been seeing a therapist.
Oh my God. I think that's great. I think that's so wonderful. I think that's so gutsy.
All right, take it easy.
But I just think that's very, very wonderful.
Well, you think I was Hannibal Lecter before or something?
I just think it's great. It's like...
So Hannibal Lecter. Also, I think that's the scene where I first realized, like, wow, Edie Falco is just crushing this.
Yeah, she ends up throughout the series convincing me that she is maybe the greatest actress I've ever seen, and that this is the greatest television character ever made. I love Carmela Soprano more than any one character on that show, and maybe more than any character on any show ever.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bold.
Well, not just in terms of like the depth of the character and the emotional depth, but also just in terms of like the acting skills. I mean, I really have never emoted watching a TV show before this. Because, uh-huh. Okay, came out in 1999, all right? So as I'm like, what, was I 15 at the time, 14? And so as I'm watching this series, I am also becoming more and more mentally mature,
sure.
emotionally mature. Yes. And so I kind of like eventually started just there's certain scenes in this entire series that I just with whenever Carmela's on screen, I feel like I'm actually watching a human being as opposed to most characters in most TV shows. You feel like you're watching an actor kind of play somebody.
Right.
But yeah, she's great. And also it was when I realized that I was just really into older women.
Sure, sure. Did you talk to her for the book? Alan?
No, we didn't do new interviews with any of the actors, and I've interviewed her a bunch, both when she was doing that and when she was under Jackie. Edie's really interesting. She's not a great interview because she's very, like, no-nonsense and not super introspective or fussy about her work. She's sort of like, I showed up, I did this, I did that, and even when other people talk about her, it's like Gandolfini really struggled with the role because he internalized so much of it.
Yeah.
And Edie could just flip it on and off like a light switch.
That is so insane.
Yeah, and when we talked to Chase about like how much feedback they got from the actors and specifically from the three leads, he said, you know, Jim would complain about stuff all the time. Lorraine would question stuff sometimes. Edie never questioned anything. She just showed up and did whatever you told her to do.
Yeah, that's why she's great. And both her and the storytelling itself, it does this thing that I feel like all great storytelling does to some extent where she introduces you to this character who is one part recognizable. Like that character is very much feels like a person or a type that you've seen.
Sure.
But also it has like additional facets that you haven't. And so it sort of creates this very round, like it's not imitation.
Sure.
Like it's part imitation, but then also part creating a much rounder emotional arc for that character.
Yeah, and it's wild to hear that she didn't internalize a lot of this and then also, you know, just could turn it on like that. Because usually the stories about great actors is that they're just total pieces of shit. Like yeah. you fucking can't hear anything about, like, anytime anyone tries to tell me anything about Daniel Day-Lewis, I stop them immediately because I know he's bad. I know he's probably terrible, not just to like work with, but probably just to be near.
Right.
He's probably one of those guys who like you can't eat next to this dude because he's gonna pretend to eat like, you know, fucking Abraham Lincoln. Like, yeah. I don't want to hear about it because
look at him over there eating like Lincoln.
Yeah, just you know the way Lincoln. Everyone knows how he
eats. Yeah, eats Lincoln logs.
Yep, a lot of Lincoln logs. So you know, I don't. When an actor is amazing, I just assume that on the inside they're either fully internalizing the character, or they just have nothing at all going on inside. But it's great to hear that she's. I mean, it sounds like she's humble. Which
right.
is nice.
Yes.
I mean, she sounds like she's humbled by her experience playing Carmela.
She is, and she's so good that it's funny. When you look at all the shows that came after that copied The Sopranos in some way, people on all those shows, they hate the wife character.
Right.
They hate Betty Draper. They hate Skylar White. They hate all of them. For the most part, nobody hated Carmela, and I think a lot of that is just Edie was so good that you couldn't help but sympathize with her, and you couldn't kind of turn on her. Not that the other actresses were bad, but... Like, this is one of the great dramatic performances, along with what Gandolfini was doing right next to her.
Yeah.
Well, and I think part of that is that a lot of times when it's a male screenwriter, you kind of get the feeling when they write a female character where they're kind of like, you know how, like, when your wife is a bitch and she's always being a big pain in the ass.
She just nags and nags, you know? It's that character.
Yeah. So, like, so Carmela's like, she has a little bit of hectoring in her, but it's so much more than that. Like, she's definitely like a complete character where she has like sort of this adversarial relationship with her daughter and Tony's caught in between. But you understand completely why she has that relationship with her daughter. It's not like she's not just being dramatic. She's trying to not raise her daughter as a pain in the ass because... And her daughter is partially learning all the wrong lessons from her dad, who's a criminal. Uh-huh. And she's trying to make the daughter, you know, be like a good person and raise her in the correct way.
Right.
But that ends up making her Hector.
Right, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, she plays a really natural mother character. It's like, it feels like the type of character and the type of relationship, mother-daughter relationship you'd see, you know, in real life or on any show.
Yeah.
All, but you know, with this thing hanging over them, which is that they are a mafioso family, which is, you know, one of the at one point, while Carmella in the pilot is... trying to get Meadow to come with her to eat at the plaza under the picture of Eloise. You know, there's this moment where Meadow basically implies by saying nothing that, you know, listen, we're in this mafioso family.
Yeah.
And of course, anytime there's a silence by one of the kids, there's always the line after it, which is, what, you got something you want to say to me? I'm just, it's great because everyone projects on the show.
Well, also, and like, kids don't tell you what is wrong with you. They kind of just, they do speak that through silence.
Yeah, they're and especially Meadow Soprano. She's brilliant at that as a character in the show. She knows how to cut down her entire family by almost not saying a word, or like just saying a little bit. And mm-hmm. It's a mirrors a little bit of Olivia Soprano in that sense, except for she was born with like empathy and a soul and whatnot. And then you're also introduced to her friend Hunter, who is going to play a part in this season, but then not much after the fact. I think later, a few episodes later, they will do meth together, which or speed,
mm-hmm.
Maybe both speed. And
which and that whole storyline is sort of the classic story where you want to make money and give your kids a better life, but then once you do, you sometimes notice that they've become spoiled brats and
right.
moved away from you in some way.
Right. Yeah. 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 You try to protect your kids and shelter them from like the realities of the life that of the job that he has, and instead you turn them into private school monsters. I mean, although I don't know if they specifically went to a private school in the show. Was that a private school?
Yeah, they were going to a private Catholic school. And Hunter, by the way, was played by David Chase's daughter.
Really? I did not know that.
So is David Chase Italian?
Yes, his real name is Di Cesare, and he Anglicanized it when he became a screenwriter. And like Steve Van Zandt even tells the story about how when he went in to meet with him, he assumed, oh, this guy, you know, another wasp writing an Italian show. I'm going to tell him what for. And then he found out just how Italian Chase was.
Right. It's funny because like there's a tradition of, you know, Jewish actors changing their having a stage name to sound less Jewish, but I think there's also a lot of Italians that do that, and
yeah,
people
sure.
don't know it as well.
Right.
Like I read Gary Marshall's book recently, and I had no idea that Gary Marshall was Italian for like the entire time I knew of him, because he seems like the most Jewish guy
totally
in the world, but no, he's actually an Italian guy.
Yeah, that blows my mind.
Yeah, and so I think Chase falls into that category to some extent.
Yeah, to be honest, I just learned he was Italian just now.
Yeah, and so I also read up on Gandolfini, who was from Jersey, and his parents were Italians, and they spoke Italian in the home, and
Yeah. And yeah, in this show, I feel like introduced me to the kind of Italian-American slang of Italian words.
Right.
So we're going to have another bumper that it will be coming very shortly of a section called Gabba Vafangul.
Right. And I actually, there was actually an interesting explainer about how that slang sort of came about on Atlas Obscura.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of sense. It's very in depth. There's times I wish I'd studied linguistics instead of all the dumb art crap that I studied.
Yeah. Because both are very, very good degrees worth a lot of money.
So this is from Atlas Obscura. The stereotypical Italian "It's a me, Mario" addition of a vowel is done for the same reason. Italian is a very fluid musical language, and Italian speakers will try to eliminate the awkwardness of going consonant to consonant. So they'll just add in a generic vowel sound, ah or between consonants to make it flow better. Mm-hmm. Second, a lot of the O sounds will be, as we call it in linguistics, raised, so it'll be pronounced more like ooh. Got it? O equals ooh. And third, a lot of what we call the voiceless consonants like a K sound, will be pronounced as a voiced consonant, says Olivo Shaw. This is a tricky one to explain, but basically the difference between a voiced and a voiceless consonant can be felt if you place your fingers over your Adam's apple and say as short of a sound with that consonant as you can. A voiced consonant will cause a vibration, and a voiceless will not. Man, so, like, when you try to make just a G sound, it'll come out as G. But a K sound can be made without using your vocal cords at all, preventing a vibration. So K would be voiceless, and G would be voiced. Try it. It's fun. Okay, so we've got three linguistic quirks common to most of the Southern Italian ancient languages. Now try to pronounce capicola. The C sounds, which are really K sounds, become voice so that they turn into G. Do the same with P, since that's a voiceless consonant, and we want voiced ones, so change that to a B. The second to last vowel sound, an O sound, gets raised, so change that to an U. And toss out the last syllable. It's just a vowel. Who needs it? Now try again.
Capicola!
Yeah. So, like, when you say capicola, like, the next word after capicola would usually start with a vowel, so you drop the vowel.
Right, right, right.
And so, hence, gabagool, and hence our segment, gabavafangool. Here's a little bit of that.
What are you doing here?
Hey, Gabriel sends me down here for the gabagool.
The gabagool.
Best shot yet.
And then here's Tony when he's ranting at Melfi.
And then it's dysfunction this and dysfunction that and dysfunction my fungal.
Had some good times.
Yeah. So I don't know how, like, I had heard that a little bit, but definitely not to the extent that I heard it on The Sopranos.
Yeah, no, I'd never heard gabagool. I grew up in Los Angeles. There's Italian Americans, but, you know, at this point, you know, I feel like this generation of Italian Americans, at least in Los Angeles, aren't talking about gabagool.
Right. So this is the button paragraph of that Atlas Obscura piece, which I really enjoyed. If you were to go to southern Italy, you wouldn't find people saying gabagool. But some of the old quirks of the old languages survived into the accents of standard Italian used there. In Sicily or Calabria, you might indeed find someone ordering mozzarella. In their own weird way, Jersey and New York and Rhode Island and Philadelphia Italians are keeping the flame of their languages alive even better than Italian Italians. There's something both a little silly and a little wonderful about someone who doesn't even speak the language putting on an antiquated accent for a dead sub-language to order some cheese.
Yeah. It does make it sound more delicious when you say
it does.
Mozzarella.
Yeah.
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 Instead of mozzarella.
Well, if you guys want to know a little secret about how the book sausage is made... Mm-hmm. I went out of my way to never once have to write the word gabagool at any point in it, because to this day, 20 years after I first wrote about the show, I cannot fucking spell it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's because it's not a real word, so you kind of just spell it however you want to.
Yeah, when I was looking for where in the script, because I wanted to do a count, how many gabagools do we have in this? How many vafangools do we have in this? And they just spell it capicola instead. Mm-hmm. Which is unfortunate.
I definitely remember being chastised by family not to say like ricotta or mozzarella. Like, oh, you want to sound like a fucking hillbilly, you say it like that.
Interesting.
And so it is easier to say arigot or mozzarella.
I love how you have to shrug when you do it and then put your hands up like, arigot.
Yeah, hey, what do you want to give us some arigot?
Here's a question. Why do they still call it, why wouldn't it just be zeet? Why is it ZD? You ever think about that? Yeah. See?
I think the E is plural, no?
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I think so.
That makes a lot of sense.
I think. I don't know. I actually
Well, you're
don't
the
speak
res- you're the resident Italian.
I don't speak in Italian.
You're going to have to learn if you want to do a show about The Sopranos.
Sure.
So how do we want to end this show?
The eternal question.
The eternal question.
I'll simply say that, like, from start to finish, mm-hmm. The show, like, I don't really, like, it was pretty much good and held up basically from opening credits to end credits, and I was shocked at how well it held up.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's clearly, you know, one of the better pilots of a TV show that's ever been made. So it's like, talking about this show is an interesting thing, because the only way you can everything is relative to how good The Sopranos is.
Yeah.
So when I say, you know, like something like, James Gandolfini, you know, his accent was, he was still figuring it out, you know, during the course of the show, it's not a put down of the show.
No.
It's just saying, you know, that for this show, that was, you know, that was a little weird.
I mean, the first season of any show, the characters right. haven't quite nailed that character yet.
Sure,
a lot of the time.
Of course,
they're still finding it a little bit. Yeah. Like
Homer Simpson
sound,
is a perfect example.
You know, the same.
Yeah.
So yeah. So basically, we started this, and I expected it to be sort of like doing homework.
Sure.
And then instantly it wasn't. I was just enjoying it.
Yeah, no, as it turns out, it's a TV show, so it's very entertaining and fun to watch. And in terms of HBO and a boob count, there's plenty of boobs in this show.
Sure,
lots of boobs.
Yeah.
You know, that was the original reason I watched the show when I was a kid. I mm-hmm. was like... you know, there's titties on this show. And then as I watched it, I was like, this show is so much more than titties. And I think...
Did they say anything about that, Alan? Because it seemed like that era of late night cable had to have a certain amount of nudity just to compete with Skinamax and HBO Real Sex.
I don't think we specifically talked about that. Although he did cop to, like, sometimes there's sort of this border between the show judging these guys for having this world and the show kind of leering at the women. It doesn't happen often. But it happens often enough that you kind of notice, especially when you go back and you watch it again a second, a third, a fourth time.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it does start out with the shot of Tony in a waiting room, in Melfi's waiting room, just looking at a statue's tits.
That right. is, yeah, that's yes. true.
That's the opening shot of the show. So you know it's going to be a show loosely about tits. But yeah. also about, you know, family.
Well, and then I think that also ties back into Portnoy's complaint is the sort of the idea that when you go to do psychotherapy, it's very tied in with your reptilian sexuality.
Exactly.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or the id and whatnot.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. All in all, I would say I give this 5 stars out of 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this, that is the pilot, and we are going to go through every episode one by one by one, each time with a new guest, talking about what we liked about the episode, what we disliked, and Alan, once again, first of all, thank you so much for being on the show. And what?
My pleasure, guys.
What is the name of the book? The Sopranos?
It's the Sopranos Sessions. Uh-huh. It has recaps of every single episode, so you can watch every episode, you can read our recap, and then you can listen to this podcast. It all comes together. And then we did this new series of interviews with David Chase covering every season, going into all sorts of weird Sopranos trivia from soup to nuts. He talked shockingly a lot about the final scene and his intentions behind it. And it also has a bunch of archival material that Matt and I wrote when we were writing about the show as it aired for the Star Ledger back in the day. So it is a big, you know, doorstop-sized tribute to one of the greatest and most important shows ever made.
And if you read that and listen to this, you will know more about The Sopranos than anyone that you know.
I'd like to think that if you read that and listen to this, you'll actually learn a little bit less by listening to this podcast, because mostly I'm just going to talk about how many tits there were in the episode and how many times they said gabagool. Because that's what this show's about. Alan, again, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure, guys.
All right. And thank you out there for listening. How would we end the show? What would you say? A line. Like we have for the Frogcast, we have a line. What's our line for this one?
Hey, forget about it.
Forget. Well, no, then we're telling people to forget about the show.
Oh, right. Yeah. Remember.
What if we just play Don't Stop Believing and then cut it?
Okay.
All right. We're going to do that. Good night, everyone.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.